Welcome to Focus on the Community, produced by DLC Media News Center. I'm Kevin Rader, filling in for Dave Crooks, with our special guest today, former Senator Evan Bayh. Senator, I could say former senator, former governor, former secretary of state, but either way, welcome.
Well, thank you, Kevin. You can call me a Hoosier. That'll make me happiest.
Yeah, there we go. That's probably right. Tell me about, you caught my attention earlier this week because of something that you had put out about your sons. So let's start with that. I know you obviously have two sons, Beau and Nick. Tell me how they're doing.
Kevin, I'm happy to report they're doing great. And one is about to finish his MBA, and he's a happy young man because he's very academically strong. He takes after his mom, not his dad in that regard, but he could do about anything. And he's been offered a place with the Indianapolis Colts. So he's going to be working with Chris Ballard going forward, and his goal someday is to maybe help run an NFL franchise. So he's really happy.
And that is Nick, and, Senator?
Yeah, that's Nick. That's Nick. You know, after college, he went into the Army, became an intelligence officer. He's now in the reserves, and that will be coming to an end. So he's looking forward to joining the Colts. And then his brother, Beau, joined the Marine Corps, and he's a second lieutenant, got promoted a couple of months ago. He finished his first year of law school. He went into the reserves, went to law school, and then he always wanted to be active duty, and so he got offered, he was recruited to go into the Pentagon. He spent the last, 7 to 8 months in the Pentagon on a top secret project. Yeah, Kevin, there's something reassuring as a parent when your children get their top secret security clearances because the FBI has checked them out and said they're okay. So either that or their college roommates were probably a lot more discreet than mine might have been. But in any event, he has his top secret security clearance and was working on a top secret project involving artificial intelligence in the Pentagon. And when this when the Russia invaded Ukraine, he volunteered to go to Europe and help be a part of our efforts to help the Ukrainians. So he's over there right now, and we'll probably be there another month or two, and then we'll come back home. He's going to be in Indianapolis this summer working for one of the large law firms there in town, and then we'll go back. He's got a couple more years of law school, and we'll do that. But right now he's in Europe and trying to do what we can to help Ukraine.
Well, that brings me right into Ukraine, Senator, because I did want to get you on that. Tell me a little bit from your perspective how you see the situation there.
Well, it's tragic, Kevin. It is. It's going to be tragic all the way around and potentially dangerous, depending on how it all turns out. So it's obviously tragic for the Ukrainians. Their cities are being destroyed. It's hard to believe, at this point in mankind's history, that 4 million people have had to flee a country in the middle of Europe, and millions more have been displaced within that country. People are being killed. It's just an awful, awful situation. And the longer it goes on, the more tragic it will become for the Ukrainians. But the ultimate irony here is it's going to be a calamity for Russia. Vladimir Putin has, for a variety of reasons we can talk about, made a mistake of historic proportions. And it's going to deeply damage Russia militarily, economically, and we'll just see how it affects them socially in the long run. But he's gotten himself into a quagmire that it's going to be very, very hard for him to extricate himself from. And as that reality dawns on him, he may become more dangerous, more violent, because he's deeply insecure. He's a little paranoid, and he has a persecution complex. And so he's also deeply conspiratorial. He doesn't believe anything happens by accident. So he will view this resistance of the Ukrainians, which is an authentic expression of their patriotism for their nation, he really will view that as something that we've caused, that the CIA, the United States government, NATO is behind it, and we're all out to get him, we're all out to weaken Russia. And so the last thing he wants to do is appear to be weak, because he thinks if he ever appears to be weak, that he'll be displaced from power. And it will encourage his enemies. And so he may become even more dangerous and violent as this thing grinds on and it becomes clear that he's not going to achieve his goals. And in fact, he's going to have to find some way to get himself out of it. So that's the real question. What does he decide to do as this thing approaches an end over the next few months? And then the other big question in the background is, Russia obviously is behaving very badly here and presents some danger to its neighbors there, and they have nuclear weapons, so obviously that's a significant risk to the rest of the world. But they're not a major competitor of ours in the long run. Their economy is only the size of Texas. We're seeing right now how really ineffective their armed forces are. And our big competitor over the next 50-100 years is going to be China. And so the big question in the background is, what do the Chinese do here? Do they decide to help the Russians behind the scenes with military aid, with food, with other support, verbal support? Or do they decide to take a different path? My guess is they'll try and play a double game, do a little bit of both. But there are actually some opportunities in this for the United States. But it could be dangerous toward the end as Putin feels cornered.
As I watch this, maybe it's the history in me, but history major in me, or an oversimplification. But I watch this and I see Vladimir Zelensky, and I think of the days of Churchill and obviously Hitler. And I think of the leadership that Zelensky is providing, not only to his country, but really to the world, which kind of reminds me, kind of echoes of Churchill, does it not?
Well, it does. I loved it when we offered him safe passage out of the country. You know, we were worried that the Russians were going to make a lightning strike on Kiev and either kill him or capture him and decapitate the government. And so we offered him a way out. And his response was, I need ammunition, not a ride, which I love that line. So, yeah. I mean, defiance in the face of tyranny and oppression, it's always inspirational. There are some echoes of Churchill there, and there are some echoes about how Nazi Germany was behaving and how Vladimir Putin is currently behaving. But, yeah, it's an inspiration. And I think in the background of all this, too, Kevin, you know, I alluded to China. So the world is going to be confronted with an increasing choice going forward, and that's the path of autocracy, which is represented by China and Russia, where you have essentially dictators or a very small group of, you know, Communist Party leaders in China running the show, no personal freedoms, controlling access of information to their citizens, controlling the economy a fair amount. So it's that command and control, top down. The state is the most powerful thing, and individuals are seen as being servants of the state. Versus our model, Western liberal democracy, which is based upon personal freedom and personal liberty, you know, political freedom, religious freedom, freedom of conscience, the ability to speak our own minds, as you and I are here doing here today, and that the state really is there to protect all of us and our personal liberties. From time to time, we have to sacrifice a little bit for the greater good, but mostly we're just based upon personal freedom and liberty. And so those are the two, you know, great paths that run throughout human history, and they're going to be playing themselves out here over the next several years, and we're seeing that become apparent in Ukraine. So, yeah, in that case, Churchill was obviously the voice of freedom and liberty against Hitler's totalitarianism, and, well, that was a monstrous regime.
I want to hearken back to the fall of the USSR and the Nunn-Lugar Act, where obviously Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana was instrumental in trying to make sure that nuclear weapons would not fall in the wrong hands with the split of the Soviet Union. And it led, in part anyway, to Ukraine losing its nuclear weapons. Looking back, Senator, is that still weather as well as it looked back then?
I think so, but it's a complicated situation. So back then, after the fall of communism in Eastern Europe and then the dissolution of part of the Soviet Union, breaking into some of its constituent parts, there was a fear. You know, there were thousands and thousands of nukes in some of those countries, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, other places besides Russia. And the fear was there that the thought was the greatest danger to humanity was that they wouldn't be controlled and that they would fall into the wrong hands, in the hands of terrorist organizations or a rogue regime that might actually use a nuclear weapon. And so that was viewed as the greatest risk. So Dick Lugar and Sam Nunn did great work in working. And the Russians saw it the same way at that point. So we needed to try, we weren't going to eliminate nukes, but we needed to try and control them, protect them, and make sure that they didn't get into the wrong hands. Now, and I think to your question, Kevin, some of these rogue regimes, I mean, certainly if you're the Ukrainians today, you're thinking, wow, was that a mistake to give up our nuclear weapons because Putin wouldn't be invading if we still had them? And I'm sure they're thinking the same thing in Iran, in Saudi Arabia, in some of these other, Kim Jong-un in North Korea, he looks at this, no way he's going to give up his nuclear weapons. And there's a man who's actually threatened to launch them against the west coast of the United States. So I'm afraid that this current event in Ukraine is teaching a somewhat different lesson to those regimes that are concerned that someday they might be threatened, and they're going to want to acquire nuclear weapons or keep the ones they've got. So Dick was right. Sam was right. It was the right thing to do. It did protect the world. But one of the lessons that these rogue regimes have taken away is that they probably don't want to participate in anything like that. And it's probably, to your question, it's not the fault of Dick Lugar and Sam Nunn, but the lesson taken from this current invasion of Ukraine is probably to some of these other nations that they want to get nukes as fast as they can. So it may actually speed up proliferation, unfortunately. Kind of ironic that the attempt to prevent proliferation back in the day, which was successful, may have now caused proliferation. But really, Kevin, it's the fault of Vladimir Putin. I mean, he's invading this country without any justification whatsoever. And who could have anticipated that?
Senator, I read a survey, changing topics a little bit, this week, saying that Indiana was the 11th largest state with unvaccinated citizens. And the reason for that was stated in this study, that it was government mistrust. And I notice now, even with the president, President Biden, who's confronted COVID, confronted Russia, and gotten infrastructure passed, you think he'd be doing better than he is in the polling numbers, but he is not. There seems to be a general mistrust of government all the way around. How do we either overcome that, or is this the new reality?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one of the most important questions of our time. Because to get back to your previous question for just a second here, Kevin, the people who really love the division that we've had in our country today, who love this distrust of government and Democrats and Republicans hating each other, liberals and conservatives hating each other, Americans thinking that other Americans are, quote, un-American and are traitors to the country. And that the people who love that are Vladimir Putin and the Chinese. They love the fact that we're so divided amongst ourselves, and they do everything they can to promote this anger and division. And so we ought to step back for a moment and think about that a little bit. But a distrust of government, it gets back to the point I was making earlier. It really is an American DNA. We rebelled against a king. In that case, we didn't want to be taxed. We didn't want to house British troops and a number of other things. And so the founding of our country, as imperfect as it was back then with the existence of slavery, was predicated on personal liberty and freedom. And so there's always been a little, our Constitution, as originally constructed, was designed to try and protect that against the encroachment of government. And so that's kind of our founding premise. And so, but it's gotten off the rails and it's gotten way too far. And it's so a little skepticism about government is absolutely in order. Where I come down, as you know, I've always been fiscally more conservative. I've liked to, when I was governor, we actually reduced taxes in Indiana. I used to think that was a good thing. Mitch Daniels once asked me at a forum why I felt that way. And I said, it's because I believe in individual liberty. I think for the most part, people know how to use their money better than the government probably could. Now we've got to raise some for public schools and for national defense and for highways and things like that. And we want to make sure that poor people can get health care and that kind of thing. But, a healthy skepticism about government is one thing, but a hostility toward government and these deep conspiracy theories that have arisen, that's really harmful. And that only plays into the hands of our adversaries like the Russians and the Chinese. So it's really gone too far, and it's kind of unfortunate because in the case that you mentioned, it's actually leading well-intended people to expose themselves to a deadly disease, and people are getting sick, and in some cases people are dying. And I feel sorry for these folks with the long haul COVID, where it just lasts and lasts and lasts. So it's unfortunate. And you say, what can we do about it? I don't know anything, Kevin, other than education, to just keep trying to get the facts out there, to try and get public figures that they might respect and listen to come forward and to say what the truth is and what the facts are. In a free country, I don't know what else you can do. So we need to keep working on that, because you're right. Look, I care deeply about the people of our state, and I want people to be healthy, and I want their families to be healthy. And the science is just overwhelming that getting the vaccine and getting boosted is the best way to accomplish that. And even former President Donald Trump and his family have been vaccinated and boosted. So it's not a partisan thing. It's just a scientific fact. And I'd be willing to bet you there are some of them who don't say they're not willing to, but the fact they're not willing to say probably tells you the answer is yes. But in Congress, Democrats, Republicans, even the most conservative ones, 99% of them have been vaccinated and boosted. So that ought to tell you something.
Senator, harkening back again, and I've used that word twice now, so I need to stop, to the Democratic Party in Indiana, you were part of what I think actually led what I would call kind of a golden age period for the Democrat Party in Indiana, you and then Governor O'Bannon and then Governor Kernan. But what has happened with the Democratic Party since, with overwhelming supermajorities in both the House and the Senate and the gubernatorial and two Senate seats? What's the prognostication for your party here in your state now?
Well, I think one thing that the national Democrats have never understood about our state is that we're a deeply conservative state, Kevin. And since my father's time, I grew up and my father was involved in politics and was privileged to be elected to the Senate three times. And going all the way back, the polling has been about consistent. There's usually 42, 43, 44% of Hoosiers describe themselves as conservative when they're asked about their ideology. And, maybe 20%, sometimes it's as low as 16, 17, 18% of Hoosiers describe themselves as a liberal. So if you're starting off 2-1 conservative, the only way the party that's viewed as being more liberal wins, it's just a math problem, right? You got to win the overwhelming majority of the moderates, the independents. And we labor a little bit under the handicap that, if Hoosiers turn on TV and they see the face of the Democratic Party being, AOC or some folks who are saying that they're socialists or they want to defund the police or, that kind of thing, that just doesn't resonate too well in our state. So to answer your question directly, we're a much more conservative state than we are a liberal state. And the image of the Democratic Party nationally is just much more liberal. And, so what's changed since my time? And my father was viewed as more liberal than me and probably was, and, economic issues and things like that. But back then, in southern Indiana and other parts of our state, you had, conservative Democrats. They wouldn't vote for Democrats at the national level quite so much, but at state level, they'd vote for Democrats if they thought you were more moderate to slightly conservative on things. And today, there's been this great sorting out, and there's not as much ticket splitting. For example, Kevin, you'll recall my first race for governor, George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, defeated Michael Dukakis by 20%. And I was privileged to be elected governor by 6. That's 26% of the people split their vote. That doesn't happen today. People are just much more party line voting. And it's because there's just so much negativity, just all the negative ads. People tend to throw up their hands and they say, I don't trust any of these people. They're all no good. I don't believe any of them. So I'm just going to go to my default position. And if I'm a conservative, I'll vote Republican. And if I'm a liberal, I'll vote Democrat. Well, in the state of Indiana, that means that Republicans win all the time. So that's kind of it. It's the image of the two national parties and the lack of ticket splitting and judging the candidates, as individuals and more just judging them by the image of the party writ large as opposed to the individual characteristics of the candidate who happens to be running.
Senator, I think most people in Indiana and probably the country realize that you were on the short list for President Obama to be Vice President of the United States when he chose then Senator Joe Biden. So you very well could have been in the position that Biden is in now. But as you look now at your career, is your career in politics over? Will Evan Bayh ever run again or maybe take any appointed position of some kind?
Are you trying to frighten your listeners, Kevin? I'm not going to run for office again, Kevin. I think I've taken the cure on that. I was privileged to run 6 times and was honored to win 5. And, you know, but I think it's time to pass the baton. Now, if the president, you know, following my wife's passing, he did ask if I would be willing to serve. And I was flattered, but I just was not in a position to do that at that moment. And but I did tell him, I said, look, you know, give me a chance to kind of get my feet under me and get over all this and get my son settled. And then, you know, if my country calls me, I'll always answer the call. I mean, it depends on what the position is. It would have to be something of, you know, substance and significance. But, yeah, I'm one of those people that if the president of the United States says that he needs you, the country needs you, I think you should say yes.
Senator, can I run? We're running short or getting close to the end now, but I want to run some individual names by you just to get your response of people who think have made a difference. And like this week, the passing of Madeleine Albright. Tell me about her.
A wonderful woman, a great backstory. You know, her parents fled Czechoslovakia shortly after the Nazis moved in, and she came to this country at a time when women didn't have that many opportunities. Worked hard and made a fabulous career for herself in you know, foreign policy circles, and became the first woman Secretary of State. So, very sharp, very tough, and you know, persevered in the face of adversity. I had a lot of respect for her.
Ketanji Brown Jackson, as she's been going through the Supreme Court hearings this week.
You know, I've not followed that all that closely, to be honest. So. And it's unfortunate the Supreme Court hearings really have turned into, you know, political footballs back and forth. But as far as I can see from what I have read, she's obviously a very intelligent person and a very capable person. I'm not familiar with, you know, her voting record on the bench and that sort of thing. But, you know, she seems to be well qualified.
Her discussion yesterday when she gave the advice to all Americans to persevere, I thought was just incredible. That's the only reason. That's why I brought her name up today.
You know, now, well, you know, it was. I used to think it was sad, and my father used to get involved in those nominations all the time. It was sad. You got these incredibly intelligent people who are nominated for the Supreme Court, and it's just become a political football. And one side almost automatically, and both sides are guilty, almost automatically tries to destroy whoever the other side puts up. And it's, you know, it's not really. They kind of play a game of gotcha and that sort of kind of thing. As I said, both sides have done this. And they used to come in, and I would interview them and talk to them. And they were kind of coached up to very carefully answer questions in a way that really didn't answer questions. And so it's kind of sad that way, but it's how it's become.
Senator, and I know you brought her name up already a couple of times. I wanted to wait till the end of the interview here. I wanted to ask you about life after Susan. Tell me about that.
Well, whenever you've been married 35 years, you know, it won't be the same, and we miss her every day. And what can I say? She's a wonderful woman, a wonderful first lady, tremendous mother and spouse, and it's just tragic, and I'll never understand why her life was cut short. But I'm doing the best I can to make sure our boys are okay, young men, I should say. And I know she'd be tremendously proud of them, and she was just a force for happiness and light and cheerful, and the world would be a better place if we had more people like her.
Quickly, because I know we're down to about a minute, any political aspirations of your sons at all?
I'm hoping they're smarter than that, Kevin. So far, I think they're, you know, their decision to both join the military after college, I think speaks to their fact that they want to help our country, that they believe in public service. There are a lot of ways to go about that besides running for public office. So I suppose it's possible. We'll see. But, you know, I've told them the same thing that my father told me, which is you shouldn't just do what your father did. They love me, and that means more to me than anything in the world. But they need to lead their own lives and find fulfillment in their own way. If that happens to be doing something similar to what their father and grandfather did, well, then wonderful. But if not, that's fine, too, because it's got to be authentic to them. So whether it's serving in the military, which they've done, or teaching, or being involved in philanthropy or some other kind of public service, I'm sure that will be a part of their lives. But running for public office, I think only time will tell. As a citizen, I think it would be great because they're smart, you know, publicly minded. They've got good values. They're honest. But as a father, I mean, who would want their child to go into politics today? So I guess I have two minds about all that.
Senator, thank you very much for your time. I know how busy you are, and I sincerely appreciate the chance to talk to you. It's good to hear from you.
Kevin, it's great hearing from you. God bless you and all the listeners.
Focus on the Community is produced by DLC Media News Center. Tune in Saturday, 6 a.m. on 104.9 WAXI in Rockville, Clinton. And you can stream at 1049WAXI.com or Saturday, 7 a.m. on WAMB AM 1130 and at 106.9 in Brazil and 99.5 WAMB in Terre Haute, where you can stream WAMBRadio.com. And Sunday, 6 a.m. on 105.5 WVIG in West Terre Haute, where you can stream it at WVIGTheLegend.com. And finally, Sunday, 7 a.m. at 92.7 The Rock on WFMB in Brazil, where you can stream it at 927TheRock.com. And downloads are available via each website beginning on Monday afternoon. For Dave Crooks, Kevin Rader filling in, and it's been a pleasure to spend this time with Senator Bayh. Thank you for joining us. And have a good week.